program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine, a magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll read from the September 2020 issue, Smithsonian. We'll begin with an article titled, "The Bombing and the Breakthrough," by Janet Conant. How a chemical weapons disaster in World War II led to a U.S. cover-up and a new cancer treatment. The old port town of Bari, on Italy's Adriatic coast, was bustling. It was December 2, 1943. The British had taken Puglia's capital in September, and though the front now lay just 150 miles to the north, the medieval city, with its massive cliffs cradling the sea, had escaped the fighting almost unscathed. Only a few miles outside of town, lines of women and children begged for black market food. But here, shop windows were full of fruit, cakes, and bread. Young couples strolled arm in arm. Even ice cream vendors were doing a brisk trade. Bari was a Mediterranean service hub, supplying the 500,000 Allied troops engaged in driving the Germans out of Italy. Grand waterfront buildings were recently designated the headquarters of the United States 15th Air Force. The liberating Tommies had already chased the Nazis from the skies over Italy, and the British, who controlled the port, were so confident they had won the air war that Air Marshal Sir Arthur Cunningham announced that Bari was all but immune from attack. "I would regard it as a personal affront and insult if the Luftwaffe should attempt any significant action in this area," he said that day at a press conference. 4 days earlier, the American Liberty ship John Harvey had pulled in with a convoy of 9 other merchantmen, and some 30 Allied ships were crammed into the harbor, packed against the seawall and along the pier. Their holds were laden with everything from food and medical gear to engines, corrugated steel for landing strips, and 50-gallon drums of aviation fuel. Visible on the upper decks were tanks, armored personnel carriers, jeeps, and ambulances. Bright lights winked atop huge cranes that hoisted baled equipment up and out. At 7:35 p.m., a blinding flash followed by a terrific bang. The ancient port's single anti-aircraft battery opened fire. Then came an ear-splitting explosion, then another and another. German junkers, Ju-88s, flew in low over the town, dropping bombs short of the harbor. Smoke and flames rose from the city's winding streets. As incendiaries rained down on the harbor, turning night into day, gunners aboard the anchored ship scrambled to shoot down the enemy too late. The attacking German airplanes fled into the night. The raid lasted less than 20 minutes. Soon a tremendous roar came from the harbor. An exploding ammunition tanker sent a huge rolling mass of flames 1,000 feet high. A reporter for Time magazine noted a fiery panorama. 8 ships were already burning fiercely. He wrote, and the entire center of the harbor was covered with burning oil. A ruptured bulk fuel pipeline sent thousands of gallons gushing into the harbor, where it ignited into a gigantic sheet of flame, engulfing the entire north side of the port. Flames leapt from ship to ship. Crews worked frantically to free ships before raging fires forced them to jump overboard and swim for it. The attack on Bari, which the press called a Little Pearl Harbor, shook the complacency of the Allied forces, who had all been convinced of their air superiority in Italy. All told, the Nazis sunk 17 Allied ships and destroyed more than 31,000 tons of valuable cargo. More than 1,000 American and British servicemen were killed, and almost as many wounded, along with hundreds of civilians. In the crucial days that followed, the task of treating gravely injured sailors would have made even more difficult by wartime secrecy. It would be almost 30 years before the world would learn the truth about what really took place that night, and even today, few are aware of the surprising role of the disaster and its impact on the lives of ordinary Americans. Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Francis Alexander, asleep in his quarters at Allied Force headquarters in Algiers, was awake at the first harsh jangle of the telephone. There appeared to be a developing medical crisis in Bari. Too many men were dying too quickly of unexplained causes. The symptoms were unlike anything military physicians had seen before, and they had begun to suspect that the Germans had used an unknown poison gas. There was an urgent request for assistance. Alexander, a medical officer attached to the staff of General Dwight D. Eisenhower at AFHQ, had received special training in chemical warfare. He was being dispatched immediately to the scene. Alexander looked young for a combat physician. 5'8" and skinny, he was 29, and only the hair thinning at his temples lent him an air of authority. He was popular with the troops, though some patients kidded that his gentle bedside manner was better suited to a pediatrician. But he had been through the brutal invasions of North Africa under Major General George S. Patton, and despite a quiet modesty, Alexander had proven himself determined and resourceful. He could have sat out the war in a stateside hospital or research laboratory, but the desire to serve ran deep. He was descended from self-made immigrants, part of a wave of Eastern European Jews who, fleeing famine and persecution, journeyed to the United States in the 1880s and 90s and were forever grateful for the opportunity afforded them in their new home. Alexander's father was an old-fashioned family practitioner in Park Ridge, New Jersey, and Alexander's one ambition was to follow in his footsteps. After excelling at the Stanton Military Academy in Virginia, he entered Dartmouth College at age 15. A standout in his science courses, he was allowed to advance directly to medical school in his senior year, graduating at the top of his class in 1935. After completing Dartmouth's two-year program, he earned his medical degree from Columbia University and did his residency training in New York. Then Alexander returned home, where he proudly hung his shingle next to his father's. They enjoyed their sharing dream of practicing medicine together for only a few months. In the spring of 1940, Alexander notified the draft board that he was available any time. He was called up in November and spent time with the 16th Infantry Regiment stationed at Gunpowder Military Reservation in Maryland, not far from the Edgewood Arsenal, home of the Chemical Warfare Service, or CWS. Before long, he contacted CWS with an innovative new design for spectacles that fit within the facepiece of a gas mask. He was granted a patent on the spectacles, but he turned the rights over to the Army. Transferred to Edgewood, Alexander underwent a crash course in poison gases, consulting specialists and experimenting on animals to evaluate toxic agents and forms of treatment. He investigated agents' medicinal potential. After Pearl Harbor, he taught Army medical personnel how to treat chemical casualties. He was promoted to the director of the medical division of CWS's research laboratory at age 27, and when General Patton embarked in October 1942 with 35,000 troops to attack the coast of Morocco, the first time U.S. ground forces would face Axis armies, Alexander accompanied him as the consultant in chemical warfare medicine to the Western Task Force. Now, at 5 p.m. on December 7, 1943, 5 days after the attack on Bari, Alexander's plane touched down at the city airfield. Waiting for him on the tarmac was the district's senior British Royal Army Medical Corps officer and a group of hospital directors. "Their agitation was immediately apparent," Alexander recalled, "and I was taken to the hospital at once." The 98th British General Hospital, located in a large complex of brick buildings 15 minutes from the harbor, had been spared. But on the monumental scale beloved by fascists, the Bari Polyclinic housed sizable medical wards, a surgical block, and laboratories. With every fresh explosion, the building creaked and rattled, rocking like a ship in a storm. E.M. Summers Cox, a nurse from New Zealand, recalled of the attack. "Doors were wrenched off hinges, windows were shattered, and the bricked-up windows scattered their bricks like hail. A concussion blast knocked out the power, plunging the hospital into darkness. They were still sweeping up glass when the wounded began to arrive, hundreds of bloodied soldiers suffering from shock, burns, and exposure. Almost all of them are covered in thick black crude oil. The litter bearers brought up the rear, carrying the grievously injured. These were sailors who had jumped from blazing ships or swum through pools of flaming oil and were horribly burned. With so many patients needing urgent attention, there was no time to get many soldiers out of their soiled clothes, so the ward matrons did what they could. The immersion cases received a shot of morphine, blankets to keep them warm, and strong, hot, sweet tea. Then they were left to rest. A British nurse, Gladys Reese, remembered trying to fix an intravenous line by the light of a match when the wind blew through shattered windows. "We worked by the dim glow of hurricane lamps long into the night and early morning," she recalled. "Intravenous bottles were dripping from every third bed, and the corridors were crammed with patients for whom we could find no accommodation." The first unusual indication, the doctors informed Alexander, was that casualties did not present typical symptoms or respond to treatment in the typical manner. Many patients, despite a thready pulse and low blood pressure, did not appear to be in clinical shock. Instead of being restless or anxious, they were apathetic. Some even said they felt rather well, and their extremities were warm rather than cold. After dawn, nurses observed that a few of the men complained of being thirsty, even though orderlies had just gone around with the drinks cart. Suddenly, there were so many men clamoring for water, the whole ward was in an uproar. Patients were yelling about the intense heat, tearing off their clothing, and in their frenzy trying to rip off their bandages. Overnight, the majority of immersion cases had developed red and inflamed skin, with blisters, as big as balloons and heavy with fluid, Reese recalled. This, together with widespread nausea and vomiting, led doctors to think the cause might be poisonous fumes, possibly from the fuel oil and explosives. "We began to realize that most of our patients had been contaminated by something beyond all imagination," she said. 6 hours after the attack, patients who had managed to fall asleep awoke complaining of eye pain. "They said their eyes felt gritty, as though sand particles had gotten in," Alexander wrote in his report. Within 24 hours, the wards were full of men with eyes swollen shut. As the staff's unease deepened, British Naval Headquarters sent a notification that there was a possibility of blister gas exposure among the casualties. The hundreds of burn patients with unusual symptoms were to be classified as dermatitis NYD, not yet diagnosed, pending further instructions. Given the crush of casualties that first night, non-urgent cases who had appeared to be in good condition were sent away, sometimes in their wet uniforms. The next morning, many returned, clearly needing treatment. Nurses tried to clean them up, scrubbing the black scum from patients' skin with kerosene, but many took a turn for the worse. "We did everything humanly possible, but it was no good," Reese said. "It was horrible to see these boys so young and in so much obvious pain. We couldn't even give them strong sedatives, since we weren't quite sure how they would react with whatever had poisoned them." The first unexplained death occurred 18 hours after the attack. Within 2 days, there were 14. Alexander noted the startling downward spiral. "Individuals that appeared in rather good condition in a matter of minutes would become moribund and die," the doctors told him. The British doctors were mystified. The symptoms did not correspond to case histories of mustard gas poisoning from World War I or to manuals issued by the Chemical Warfare Service. If the toxic agent was mustard, named for its unpleasant garlicky odor, respiratory complications should have been more prominent. Several days later, patients with no previous respiratory problems became congested and developed very sore throats, making it hard to swallow. The patients died not of the result of bronchopneumonia, as might have been expected, but from cardiocirculatory failure. Alexander walked the crowded wards. He examined patients, gently lifting blankets to study their wounds. With extraordinary delicacy, he probed the strange patches of thickened red skin. He spoke with each patient in turn, asking how he had come by these injuries. What ship was he on? How did he become to be rescued? Did he receive first aid at the docks? What about at the hospital? One sailor after another told him of being caught in the firestorm and the pandemonium of somehow making it to the hospital. There they had waited for as long as 12 and even 24 hours before receiving treatment. Drawing back the covers from one patient, Alexander studied the burns on an otherwise healthy body. The sailor said he had been aboard a PT boat in the harbor when the German bombers flew over. He heard a loud boom as a nearby ship blew up, and the boat was hightailing it back to shore when he felt a spray of oily liquid land on his neck and run down his chest and back. Alexander observed the outline of raw, raised skin, shiny with ointment, delineating where he had been sprayed as if the splash had been imprinted on his flesh. The burns Alexander had seen on other patients were varied, but already he could distinguish between chemical burns and those caused by fire and heat. Certain patterns were present depending on how the individual had been exposed. It appeared to Alexander that sailors who had been thrown overboard and completely immersed in the harbor were burned extensively, while those in boats had comparatively superficial burns wherever the toxic soup had hit them. Several men who had sat in the solution, possibly in lifeboats, had only local burns of the buttocks and groin. A few lucky souls who took it upon themselves to wipe off the oily mixture that first night sustained only minor injuries. As he made his rounds, it was increasingly clear to Alexander that most of these patients had been exposed to a chemical agent. His sense of smell supported his hypothesis. Entering the hospital, he had noticed something different from the usual cloying mix of sweat, urine, and disinfectant. "Traces of an odor implanted in my mind," said mustard gas, he later recalled. He knew that the three most common blister agents were sulfur mustard, Lewisite, and nitrogen mustard. Although generally referred to as gas, all three agents were liquids at room temperature, and all three produced skin injuries resembling burns and serious eye injuries. Particularly worrying was the new pure grain nitrogen mustard developed by the Germans, which Alexander had studied the previous year at Edgewood, after two classified samples were smuggled out of Germany. Its effects were reportedly more rapid than sulfur mustard, and it could penetrate intact skin and cause systemic poisoning. Practically colorless and odorless, apart from a faint fishy smell, it was not easily detected in the field. The Germans were also known to use mixtures of blister agents, so any combination was a real possibility. It had been 5 days since the initial exposure, and if there was any chance of saving the hundreds of Allied sailors lying in hospitals all over Bari, plus countless Italian civilians, he would need to act swiftly. He decided to put the question directly to the commanding officer of the 98th General Hospital, Colonel Wellington J. Laird. "I feel these men may have been exposed to mustard in some manner, Colonel," Alexander said tentatively. "Do you have any idea how this might have happened?" "None," came Laird's reply. As the chemical warfare consultant to AFHQ, Alexander was cleared to the highest degree. He knew the Allies had begun secretly stockpiling poison gas in the Mediterranean, in case Germany, with its back against the wall, resorted to all-out chemical warfare. But he was skeptical that the Allies would have shipped mustard shells in a busy port like Bari, and allowed the toxic cargo to sit there as a prime target for an enemy strike. Still, Alexander couldn't rule it out. Tactfully, he tried again. "Have you checked with the port authorities?" he asked Laird. "Could the ships in the harbor have been carrying mustard?" Laird replied, "I have, and they tell me they have no such information available." The burden of proof rested on him. He ordered a series of tests for the patients who were still alive, insisted on careful and complete autopsies on patients who had died under mysterious circumstances. He ordered samples of the harbor waters collected and analyzed. He borrowed personnel from displaced hospital units and put them to work gathering data, performing lab tests on tissue samples, and compiling pathology reports. Suspecting that Laird had dodged his question, Alexander visited Navy House, the British Admiralty's local headquarters. Weary after the long day, he was blunt. Was there mustard gas in Bari Harbor? This was again absolutely denied. Alexander left unconvinced. What he needed was proof. But this was not the familiar menace he had studied at Edgewood. This was a new horror. Mustard gas poisoning, though, in a different guise than that recognized from World War I, he wrote later. At first light, Stuart Alexander headed for the harbor. He picked his way through mounds of rubble and surveyed the twisted skeletal remains of the Allied convoys. Out on the mole, men were working like ants, removing jagged chunks of concrete and scrap metal. The port, which had been closed for 5 days and swept for mines, had partially reopened that morning. A number of burned-out vessels had already been towed out to sea and sunk or blown apart. A coal barge still smoldered on a quay close by, and the fly ash stung his nostrils. The dark oil-slimed water in the harbor basin looked sinister. One sailor had recalled that the floating oil had been a foot thick on the surface of the water after the raid. It was a mixture of high-octane gasoline and fuel from 24 Allied ships, and Alexander suspected mustard gas or a derivative, possibly dropped by the Germans among the incendiary bombs. Alexander wondered what other agents might have been thrown into the mix. The Germans possessed phosphorus and magnesium bombs, both of which would have caused deep chemical burns and eye injuries. Another possibility was that an Allied cargo ship had been carrying white phosphorus shells and smoke pots, designed to mask approaches and unnerve the enemy, which was released when the vessel was hit. If it was an aerial gas attack, determining which ships were hit and in what order would help him understand which crews suffered the most direct exposure. Even men not on the water would have inhaled significant doses of the noxious vapor as it spread across the harbor, some of it sinking, some burning, some mixing with the tons of oil floating on the surface, and some evaporating and mingling with the clouds of smoke and flame. German planes could have dropped time-fused mustard bombs that would burst open approximately 200 feet above the water in a low-altitude spray attack, could have released liquid mustard from tanks that would then be transformed by the slipstream into tiny droplets resembling a vapor. Alexander reasoned that in either case of the attack would have contaminated all the ships in the inner harbor, including the crippled vessels that remained afloat, and drenched all the men on the docks below. Yet Alexander found no evidence of mustard contamination in his survey of the dock area. The Royal Navy personnel he interviewed appeared shocked at the suggestion that poison gas might have been released in the air raid. "Mustard?" one British officer repeated in surprise, shaking his head. "That's impossible. There's no mustard here." When he spoke with British port authorities, they continued to state categorically that there had been no mustard in the area. Undeterred, Alexander described in ghastly detail the ghastly burns he had seen at the hospital, and he insisted that there was no way those injuries could have been sustained by anything except chemical exposure. Of the 534 men admitted to the Allied hospitals following the attack, 281 were suffering from symptoms consistent with mustard poisoning. That day, 45 had died. These were just the documented cases. Many more fatalities could be expected if they did not receive proper treatment urgently. The vast majority of the victims were British, their own countrymen. The authorities began to waver. They allowed that if mustard gas was present in the harbor, it could have only come from the German planes. Alexander considered the ramifications of the charge that Hitler, in a desperate gamble, had risked a gas offensive. But coming as it did after a string of firm denials of so much as a whiff of mustard in Bahrain, it seemed Alexander too neat an explanation. For days, he pored over the clinical records. Reading the reports he wrote is to take a journey into the nightmare of the effects of chemical contamination. From his training, Alexander knew that agents such as mustard are toxic in vapor or liquid form when they reach the eyes, nose, lungs, or gastrointestinal tract. But the chemicals can also be absorbed by the skin, and any toxic agent in contact primarily with the epidermis would, therefore, result in delayed clinical signs, as was the case with the baffling Bari victims. These were the symptoms he bore in mind as he studied the case of Seaman Philip Henry Stone, a patient who had abruptly died after asking for a drink. The doctors had pointed to him as an example of one of those inexplicable early deaths. The pathologist noted a generalized dusky erythema, a reddened skin on the chest, abdomen, and thighs, and many blisters on the face, ears, arms, back, and external genitalia. The lips were dull black in color, he wrote. During the autopsy, the pathologist also found that the esophagus displayed a curious black longitudinal streaking, probably due to dead cells and tissue. The lungs, a mottled blackish-red color, were congested. The bronchi were filled with pus and the trachea engorged with fluid. The stomach showed the same black areas, and there were necrotic areas near the opening, most likely caused by swallowing a diluted solution of mustard mixed with oil. After studying the reports, Alexander concluded that many sailors who sustained blast injuries would not have succumbed to the hemorrhages were it not for other complications. The serious consequences of imposing the mustard vapor injury upon a lung partially damaged or bruised by blast is at once apparent. Alexander was still trying to decide how best to proceed, given the official resistance to his diagnosis, when he received stunning news. A diver had ordered to search the harbor floor had found fractured gas shells. Tests performed on site revealed traces of mustard. Ordnance officers from the U.S. Air Force identified the casings as belonging to a 100-pound M47A2 mustard gas bomb. German mustard gas bombs were always marked with a distinctive Gelbkreuz, or yellow cross. This bomb was definitely American. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. We'll finish this article next week. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen, who wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.